listening to your community radio station. It's KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Halaiva. It's time for In the Garden, On the Farm. The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm.
This KKCR program is supported in part by Harvest Market, Kauai Marine and Mower, Anahola Stringed Instruments, and Edible Hawaiian Island Magazine.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Edible Hawaiian Islands is a subscription-based, advertiser-supported print and digital magazine, the only James Beard Award-winning food and drink magazine in the state of Hawaii. Edible Hawaiian Islands digital magazine may be enjoyed at ediblehi.com.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will overcome the insidious insect pests which can make gardening a challenge, and beneficial bugs and their favorite forage. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul.
How are you this fine day?
Excellent. Most excellent. Very good to be here with you. Getting ready to have a really great show today.
Absolutely. I am so grateful that we have the depth of knowledge in our community, our wider community in Hawaii and beyond, that makes gardening and farming so informative and well supplied with tools in our toolbox to overcome some of our most challenging problems, including insect pests, which is what we'll focus in on today. And we will be speaking with our very special guest, Dr. Layla Kaufman, coming up in the program in a little while. But we have some other great treats to share with you. And so we'll begin.
Literally.
With the celestial session, our look to the heavenly bodies above for inspiration and guidance in our planting, harvesting, and other gardening and farming activities. And we will begin with the Hawaiian moon of the day. Today's moon phase brought to us by the 2015 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar. Thank you, Hanalei Watershed Hui, as well as all their collaborators, and as well to the U.S. Naval Observatory's Astronomical Applications Department. Today's Hawaiian moon, Ole Kukahi. Ole Kukahi rose over Kauai at 12:07 a.m. this morning. She'll reach her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 6:26 a.m., or rather she did. And she will set during the show today at 12:48 p.m. 50% of the moon's face is illuminated, and you can guess probably that that means that last quarter moon was today, or is today, and the exact moment of it was at 10:24 a.m. this morning. And Ole Kukahi is the first of three Ole moons in the waning phase of the Hawaiian moon month. This day is not recommended for planting or fishing by the traditional system, according to most informants, although there was an informant, Kepalino, recommended planting today. It's thought to be windy and the tides are running high in general, and these are considered lazy days for farmers. And certainly with the heat we've been experiencing in the middle of the summertime, it certainly is a good time to observe that, perhaps. But as we know, farmers are always busy in one way or another, but maybe it's time for a little bit of the shady time activities to happen. And I want to let people know as well that the Lahaina noon, which we talked about on the show about a month ago, is coming again. I guess it's been about 5 or 6 weeks. And so thanks to the Bishop Museum for this information about this phenomenon. In the tropics, the sun passes overhead twice during the year. On these 2 days, at local noon, the sun will be exactly overhead, and an upright object, such as a flagpole, will have no shadow. This phenomenon occurs only in the tropics. The sun is never overhead in any other part of the planet.
Far out.
The dates on which this phenomenon occurs varies based on the latitude. And so here are some of the ones that are calculated out, thanks to the planetarium at the Bishop Museum. In Li Hui, this phenomenon will occur for the second time this year, coming up on July the 11th. Is that Saturday? I believe it is. And it's going to be 12:42 p.m. And they didn't have any other places on Kauai, but they did have listed Honolulu. It doesn't happen until the 16th of July at 12:37 p.m. And then in Kailua Kona on Hawaii Island, July 24th. So interesting to see, even within the range of the Hawaiian Islands, how many days it varies. And based on this, I tried to do a little bit of calculation based on the relative distances between these places and calculating the differences between the latitudes. But unfortunately, my sort of elementary calculations were not able to extrapolate the difference. It's more complicated than that, based on probably the speed of the phenomenon changing or the shape of the Earth. Who knows what's at play? But it could be that Lahaina noon is happening today on the north shore of Kauai, and maybe in subsequent years we will request the Bishop Museum to actually do calculations for at least Hanalei, which is the reference point that we use for the Hawaiian moon calendar and those precise moon rising and setting times.
Yeah, pretty subtle calculations there. That's awesome. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, there's a lot going on too. It's pretty exciting today. Wednesday, the moon in Pisces, a water sign really, which should be good for leaf planting, but the calendar recommends flowers, and that is because it is the second in three light trines. So a trine is when planets are in all three of the air signs and they're triangulated together, and it makes a very potent energy. So it makes sense that that's why flower would be recommended on Wednesday today, the light trine. Thursday and Friday, the moon will be in Aries, a fire sign, making it a good time to work with our fruit plants. Saturday is unproductive for planting, so we get a little freebie there. Sunday, the moon moves into Taurus, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants. And I usually wrap up with Tuesday, as we do the shows on Wednesdays, but I will say that Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday next, although the moon's in Taurus, it's moving into Gemini, and it is the third in the three light trines that are happening, and so it's a great time to get some fruiting plants in the ground. In fact, might be one of the best times to get fruit plants in the ground, and flowers for that matter.
Super cool. Thank you for that information, and I'm hoping that you can remind me the difference between, now these are transplanting recommendations as opposed to seed sowing recommendations. Is that not the case?
Correct.
And so if it were that I wanted to take advantage of that influence, but I was sowing seeds, Does it just not influence seeds germinating in the same way, or...
I believe it would, but when the biodynamic calendar recommends planting times, they're talking specifically about transplanting. I can't see how that energy wouldn't be going to the seeds as well.
Right.
But I just wanted to give everybody a heads up, because you'll have a whole week to get prepared if you have been thinking about wanting to put some fruit trees in. And really, with the on Wednesday, that following Wednesday, it's also the new moon. It's a light fest, basically, and it is the great time. When we plant fruits, we like air times because it keeps the fruits from being rotty or too wet, and generally the influences for fruits are those drier signs, being the fire and the air, and the light sign is there for us, so soak it up. It's warmth and light and all those things that we equate with really strong growth in our plants.
Super cool. Well, I know that we're going to be paying attention to those specific recommendations at the Regeneration Seed Center this summer. Ken Lindsay, who was our special guest last week in studio, and I are working on a project to grow out 16 different varieties of seed-producing crops, all in 1/8 of an acre field. We are looking for some interns who want to learn everything about how to grow seed crops and manage the populations and learn good organic farming practices. So I want to throw out the number. Contact number is 652-4118. Be in touch with me regarding that as well. But it's very auspicious that we're having this timing where we're able to sow some seeds and hope to capture some of that great influence as well.
Absolutely. Well, moving right along, I've got an interesting notable news piece that goes along really well with our insect talk that we'll be doing today. And unfortunately, it's not really great news, I will admit. But this comes from chemistryworld.com. And the study, which was done by Newcastle University's Geraldine Wright, has found that systemic pesticides of the neonicotinoid family, which were once hailed as a green alternative to other pesticides, before, of course, colony collapse disorder kind of hit the planet in 2006 and 2007, and so it spurred further research that sublethal effects on the insect brains that interfere with the insect's ability to navigate and communicate.
Kind of similar to humans, really.
Indeed. In fact, so similar that Geraldine Wright there at Newcastle University in Britain used neuron recording techniques to show that neither honeybees or bumblebees identify these neonicotinoids by their bitter taste, which usually helps them avoid substances that include nicotine. As you can imagine, neonicotinoids are a derivative of nicotine, and nicotine itself was used as a pesticide for long time in the backyard. People would just brew up a little tobacco tea, but it would put a bitter taste on the plant, and so the bees knew to avoid it because it wasn't good for them. However, the nicotinoids don't have that bitter taste, and so the bees go after them, and just like us, the nicotine appears to be drawing them back to the plants that have neonicotinoids on it. So they will preferentially pollinate a plant that has the neonicotinoid on it, which means that they're getting higher and higher doses, and it's, things are just getting worse for them. So they, on a subtle level, really get addicted as well to these flowers that have been treated. And there, it shows significant deleterial effects of the neonicotinoid treated crops, and it's definitely bad for bees. So right now, neonicotinoids have been banned in most of Europe, and the park services in the U.S. have decided to stop using them. I think it's steps in the right direction. Certainly, our listeners, we hope that you're not heading towards any of those. There's certainly plenty of other ways, as you'll find out as the show progresses today, to handle pest problems that don't involve substances that would be so dangerous to our main pollinators.
Yes, and I'm glad this is coming more and more to the attention of the general public, which of course influences how industry, like big agricultural industry, operates. I just heard Ed Begley Jr. on Bill Maher's Real Time show as a special guest there, talking about the threat of neonicotinoids and how we really need to take better care of our honeybees. I did see in the same story, Robin, that you just cited that there's another piece of research out that says that neonicotinoids are substantially toxic to bumblebees and solitary bees, however, not honeybees. And so we could hope that at least there's a little bit of a silver lining in that way. This is a different piece of research, and it could very much be based on the location, though, and that we just don't know.
Sure, and the data collection, and then who analyzes the data and how makes a big difference, because with this first study I cited, people read it in different ways and came to different conclusions based on the exact same evidence. And when you get down to, you know, neuron recording techniques of bees, you know, we're talking about pretty minute work here. So I'm sure there's a lot of variables at play there. And I would just like to see us take better care of the very positive insects. You know, our garden is a living organism. It's in the world. There's no way the garden is ever going to be bug free, and in fact it would be terrible if it were.
Indeed.
So we want to try to keep, just like with the soil talk we heard a couple of weeks ago, we want to keep the perfect ratio of good. And you know, you like your SWAT team ladybugs out there. We'll get to all that a little bit later in the show, but for now, let's not buy any pesticide laden food,
please. And Robin, I have to say right now that you just handed me the most brilliantly illuminated glass of divine nectarous tea of the season. So I'm super grateful. And maybe you could let the listeners know what I'm enjoying and Jack is enjoying as well.
Sure. It is Roselle and lemon verbena mixed together, just fresh harvested from the garden. And the lemon verbena is a really etheric flavor to me right now. I'm really into it. And in summertime, as it's happy season here, it'll kind of tolerate our winters. Looks a little shabby, but once you see them in the summer, they just come back in full force. And I'm clipping it at a very fast rate right now. I think I'll dry some for the time of year when I don't have so much to cut fresh out of the garden.
Sweet.
And speaking of being in my garden,
yes,
I would love to take your hand and lead you through the garden gate. In my garden, and what I am really rocking out on right now, it's the perfect time of year, is tomatoes. Mm. Tomatoes, I'm picking bowls and bowls and bowls full. It is definitely the hot season plant. Tomatoes, of course, came to us from Central America. There's hundreds of varieties.
They're not from Italy?
They are not, but there's a fabulous book out there called Tomato Rhapsody about how the tomato got to Italy. It's quite humorous. At any rate, they come in so many varieties and almost every color you can possibly imagine. Most of us think red when we think tomatoes, and sure enough, the red color is just chock-a-block full of phytonutrients. So, yeah, technically speaking, tomatoes are low-calorie, they're low-fat, they have zero cholesterol. They're antioxidant powerhouse. Lycopene in the tomato protects our skin against sun cancer. Zeaxanthin, which you've heard us talk about in this segment quite a few times, is good for our eyes. It helps our eyes stay keen. High vitamin A, vitamin C, beta carotene, lutein, which we've also heard of, that is very good for night vision. Mm. B complex vitamins, leads to healthy skin, bones, and mucous membranes. And they're really rich in potassium, so really a great reason to have some tomatoes in your garden. Now, I've had many years of challenges with tomatoes, and timing seems to be so of the essence, which is, I think, why we belabor our astrological information, because when you get something in at just the right time, you know it, because the plant just goes bonkers, right? So the right variety and the right plant. And I want to say that the Juliet variety that was given to me by a very dear friend of mine has proven to be the most incredible tomato here. It is an F1. It is a hybrid plant. So it's a natural cross between two parents. and it just seems to thrive in every condition, no matter where people live on the island, whether it's a wet zone or a sandy zone. they're bringing in Juliet's, and people are telling me they have more tomatoes than they can eat. It is a red grape tomato that's a bit smaller than a plum, although I've noticed if the plant's really happy, they can get pretty big. Mm. And as we've talked about before, if you decide to sucker out your tomatoes, of course the fruits will be larger yet. Mm-hmm. But they're in such abundance, it's amazing.
That's the one I got from you. I'm really excited. It's flowering now. I got it in a bit late, but it's flowering now, and can't wait.
Great. Yeah, tomatoes are generally about 100 days to a ripe tomato. And then when you get these ones with big trusses, and they're just, there's so many of them, and there's giant bowls, and I want to stress this, on the countertop, because you do not want to refrigerate your tomatoes. It is not good to refrigerate. Some people may have heard this, and I looked into it just so I could share some more information with you, is what happens is the cold, we know that some vegetables and fruits are cold sensitive, and when you put the tomato in the refrigerator, it damages the membranes inside the fruit walls. And so not only does the fruit lose flavor, but it also makes a mealy texture, like the kind of that you buy from the grocery store in January that are so unappealing.
I'm very familiar with what you're talking
the
about.
The pink, kind of pink ones. And so I want to recommend that, you know, you when you harvest, bring them in. Do not refrigerate them. If you need to use them up because you have so many, I hope is the case, make a sauce. Dry some, slice them in half, put them in low on the low oven or in your dehydrator if you have one, and dry off some tomatoes. That's a really good way to preserve them without damaging their flavor. You know, as an Italian, the flavor of the tomato is what I'm really after. Even if I don't get so many individual fruits, what I really want is that real tomato flavor. And just saying, perfect time of year, summertime for the solanaceous crops, and tomato is a prime one, so...
Well, I hope people planted them, because if you were to get them in the ground now, you'd still have some success? Or?
Yeah, we're so lucky here in the subtropics. We really can pull off, and there's certain varieties that perform better in cooler temperatures and certain varieties that perform better in hotter summertime temperatures. Really what it comes down to, besides nutrition, I mean, there's really no one thing, but nighttime temperatures really play into the solanaceous crops, and when the nighttime temperatures stay too high, mm-hmm. the tomato just won't want to flower and fruit. So it's, in a way, the off-season, quote, is a little better. Mm. Juliet has just been such a winner for me and all my friends that I'm definitely saying that's a high-quality variety for here, for us on Kauai, pretty much any time of year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I can't wait to enjoy some of those coming up soon.
Yeah, like at lunch.
All right. Well, moving on to our feature presentation for today, we're joined on the phone by our guest, Dr. Layla Kaufman. Layla is originally from Peru, where she got an undergraduate degree in agronomy. She earned her master's degree in crop sciences in integrated pest management at, I'm not going to say this well, Wageningen University in the Netherlands.
Wageningen.
I always have difficulty with Dutch names. She got her Ph.D. in entomology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She's currently an assistant researcher at UH, working in multiple projects that deal with invasive species in natural areas as well as pests in agricultural settings. And Layla has been living in Hawaii since 2003, you lucky lady. It's super to have you on the show. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
And are we speaking to you from Oahu today?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, we're really excited about the fact that you're bringing a synthesis of work on both our beloved native plants as well as the agricultural plants. And, of course, there's connections. And, sadly, the insect pests are some of the ways that these plants are connected. And so sometimes pests that come in on one begin to afflict another. So we were hoping that we could jump in on whichever native plant that you've been focusing on most recently or you'd like to begin with.
Well, actually, I would like to begin with Erythrina. I have been working on the Arizona Gold Watch for the longest time.
Yes.
So, and as you know, the Arizona Gold Watch arrived here to Hawaii in 2005, and it quickly started infesting not only native plants, but also important exotic plants. So it was fortunate that actually the Department of Agriculture and UAH were quickly and were able to do some foreign explorations and bring a biocontrol agent that was released in 2008. That was actually a record time for a release of a biocontrol agent. And it was due to the importance of the of this native plant, the native Willy Willy. And after the release, we actually we were fortunate to see dramatic changes in the infestation levels. So I was involved first in the pre-release monitoring, which is very important in any biocontrol program.
Certainly.
Because we can document the differences between before the release and after the release. So
Dr. Kaufman, I'm sorry, can I just interrupt for a second? I just
yes.
want to make sure our listeners understand we're talking about the native Willy Willy trees. Botanically,
yes.
they're called Erythrina, and people
uh-huh.
will remember a few years ago when most of the trees started getting these gnarly galls on all the leaves and defoliating, and it was pretty much killing the trees, this gall wasp that was imported accidentally here to Hawaii, correct?
Yes, yes. Yeah, this gall wasp lays its eggs in many different tissues of the plant. Can be young leaves, petioles, stems, flowers, seed pods. So, and we actually saw dramatic changes, especially in foliage. The foliage that was coming out like 6 months or a year after, and even now like many years after, is coming clean with some infestation, like if there is variation with year to year, but overall this was a great biocontrol program. The only thing that we are seeing lately is that flowers are actually not as this dramatic change hasn't affected the flowers as much. So flowers and seed pods, especially in some places, are still heavily infested, and that's why we are continuing this for this long run, because there is actually a second biocontrol agent in quarantine right now, and HDOA is working on that. So and they are hoping to release it, and hopefully it's going to help the flowering, right? Because the flowering is the most important part, because that is, those are the seeds for the future forest.
Of course, of course. And so can you just clarify for me, what was the first biocontrol agent? Was that also a wasp?
It was also a wasp, yeah. It's Erythroma, Erythrinae. So it's actually, these wasps are more like a predator, because the larvae of the wasp, so this the biocontrol agent also lays its eggs inside the tissue of the plant, and it searches for larvae, pupa, or eggs of the gold wasp, so of the pest, and eats it. And it can eat between 1 to 5 in order to complete its life cycle and get ready for the next stage. So so this biocontrol agent, again, has been very successful, but especially in foliage, but not too much in flowers.
Right. And so what is the second biocontrol agent, also a wasp?
It's also a wasp. Yes, it's also a wasp. It's Aprosocytus nidens. And it's currently, all the laboratory work has been completed, and now it's in the stage of filing for possible release, and we will see if that is positive or not.
As I understand, and certainly we've had a lot of biocontrol mishaps that are quite famous here in Hawaii, what with the mongoose and others that have caused more problem than they even were intended to solve. But if I understand correctly, insects, or maybe even particular kinds of insects, are much safer in terms of introducing as biocontrols. Is that true?
Yes, of course. We have different kind of insects. We have like insects that are monophagous, like that only eat in a certain on a certain pest, or we have insects that can be polyphagous, means they have like a long array of pests. Of course, these large ones will not be recommended for any classical biocontrol, so bringing from one place to another, because it might switch to a different prey. Right. So it might go after something else. That's what we don't want.
So if we think about this example, and I'm assuming that the pest, the Erythrina gall wasp, existed before the parasitic insect that actually parasitizes it. And so if that stands to reason, then the pest that the biocontrol agent that was released must have been some other kind, must have been a very closely related wasp that had a different feeding preference before it started feeding on the gall wasp, and it must have changed or adapted to eating the gall wasp. Is that, well, does that make sense or no?
I don't know if I understood you right, but when a biocontrol program, like especially this one, like this one starts, so you go to the source. So it's very important to know where the pest comes from. So where is the origin? Because you want to go back to that place to actually have natural enemy that is closely related to that pest, so that it can. So that it can be successful when you bring it to a different place.
Yeah.
So and you wanna look for something that only is or mainly is associated with that pest and not with other species of insects. Uh-huh. So this Erythrina gall wasp was actually is originally from Africa, and it was collected on a different species of Erythrina, but it was an Erythrina species, and it was attacking a gall insect, a gall wasp. So, and it was brought here to Hawaii to in quarantine. So, and all the tests, the testing was done. So, in the testing, so you do host specificity testing. So, it's important to actually look and do some literature review to see which kind of gall insects do we have here in Hawaii that might be at risk if there's a host change.
I see.
So you go and look, you go through the literature, you go collect, and you do all those tests in the lab, you know, in quarantine conditions, of course, because at this point you cannot release it yet. So, and then after all these tests are done, when you actually write up a report and then you send it for a person, it has like many different channels. So, and then it has to be approved at a federal level, at the state level, and even the public now has some say on the release or not to release a biocontrol agent. So it's like many different layers, but it's very strict right now. And that's why since mid-70s, we don't have any records of any biocontrol agent that has switched hosts. So
well, that's great. That's a great track record.
Yeah, so that shows that really regulatory measures have improved dramatically, and basically that whatever we release is should be safe. But of course, like there's some like fine line there. But yeah, mm-hmm. but you have to document a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Well, the willy trees are so beloved here on the islands. They're fiery blossoms and. The wood
yeah.
that's so useful that it's just so wonderful to know there's good people like yourself working really hard to preserve their future here with us in the Hawaiian Islands.
Yeah. Actually, this is the time of the year where flowers are starting to come up. So we are actually starting to tag flowers. So what we do is we go to these sites and we tag like blossoms, little blossoms, and we follow them all the way until they are mature seed pods.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see all the process of the, like where is the window of the infestation level, how infested they are, like if they produce seeds or not. And if they are heavily infested, these pods, do the seeds germinate or not? So what we are seeing is like some cases that where there's really heavy infestation in flowers or seed pods, still the plant might be able to put seeds, but these seeds may not germinate very well, so which decreases the chances of having a healthy forest for the future.
Indeed. I want to let people know this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Layla Kaufman from UH. She's an entomologist. We're talking about the willy gall wasp, and I just wanted to say one more thing about that, is that there is a very important agricultural relative of the willy-willy, the Erythrina variegata, which was used extensively in windbreak plantings, and even the popular variety was developed at the Ho'olehua Plant Materials Center on Molokai, and yet it was perhaps even more significantly damaged than the native willy-willy tree, and so many of those windrows we saw here on Kauai and probably throughout the state just disappeared over a period of months from the infestation. I did speak with Kavika over at the Plant Materials Center today, and he told me, and I actually asked him, is it safe now because of the biocontrol release to begin replanting the variegata species? And he said, funny that you asked, because we've just been wanting to trial it again. Have you seen any recovery in that related species at all in your work?
Well, we actually, at the beginning of this pre-release monitoring and post-release, we were actually trying to include many different exotics. Some of them were actually the windbreak Erythrina that you are talking about. But, you know, there were so many few left that at the end we actually were not able to continue it, because most of our sites actually most of all the plants died out.
Wow.
So we were not able, because we were not monitoring anything in nurseries, or we were actually going to where in local farms or along the streets that we picked these sites. So, and all of these sites disappeared.
Wow. Amazing. It was such an easy to see species almost everywhere in the islands, and really shows us how quickly things can change when an invasive pest comes in with a hot, wide host range and can just knock them out.
And I have to add, regarding this specific program, it was such a great program, because we collaborated really strongly with different organizations. We work closely with people at Hawaii Department of Agriculture and DOFA, DLNR. So, and this kind of partnership was great, because we were able to cover a lot of ground. So we were able to have sites on Kauai, on Maui, Big Island, and here on Oahu, because funding for these projects are sometimes limited, and travel inter-island sometimes can be really very expensive. So in this project we were able to have many many sites, and with the help of all this organization and these people.
Yes, so we are so great. It's always great to hear that the agencies are collaborating well. We give so much thanks for that, because there's so much expertise that's held in the different organizations, and when we can all work together, we can achieve such great things.
Yeah, because especially like sometimes when different people start working on the same thing, and then sometimes you duplicate things instead of adding things up. So, which actually this kind of partnership is very important, and very and I think it's very important for Hawaii.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's turn now to another plant, another beloved native plant, and this time it's the Nio, Myoporum sandwichense, found throughout the Hawaiian Islands, known as bastard sandalwood, but really for somewhat of the aromatic quality of the wood. However, the aromatic flowers are absolutely intoxicating. And a plant that I've enjoyed so much from the west side of the Napali coast, and makes a very hardy landscape tree, and beautiful as well, but unfortunately also faced with a significant insect pest that you've been working on, Layla.
Yeah, this is Niothrips, and so this other project that I'm working on, so we started in 2010, this Myoporum thrips goes after the native Nio, and it arrived here to Hawaii, or at least was detected in 2009. So far it actually is currently restricted to the Big Island, but in the Big Island it has spread throughout the island, and all the local populations of Nio actually have come are infested, and infestation has been progressive over time. So now this Nio thrips cause gall-like symptoms, so they are not true galls, because the insect doesn't live inside the plant tissue, but it curls it up, so it forms the leaves, and it causes dieback. So the plant tissue starts dying from the tip downwards. So and heavily infested plants can die, so it can cause mortality in the long run. That's what we are actually currently seeing on the Big Island, especially in some sites. So this is a different type of thing regarding the Arizona bulbos, because here we don't have any biocontrol agent that can be used against these Nilotrips. Actually, there is no examples worldwide of a successful biocontrol program against any thrips.
Against any thrips. And Leila, would you kindly just offer a little bit to our listeners about the life cycle of the thrips? And I know they're pretty fast. They reproduce pretty quickly. I don't off the top of my head remember if they have a life cycle, part of their life cycle in the soil as well, or if it's all on the plant.
Yeah, some of them, they do have a life cycle on the soil, but in this case, it probably has a life cycle in the soil. Most thrips do. So the difference between these thrips, actually, that was interesting, like most thrips actually lay eggs inside the plant tissue, and then that's why they are very difficult to control with natural enemies, because the insects need to probe and get these tiny little eggs, because thrips are really tiny. But these species of thrips lay eggs outside, so you can actually see them if you look under a microscope. But since the thrips curls up the leaves so much, so that's why it's difficult for any a biocontrol agent or any beneficial insect to actually go after these thrips. We have been surveying since 2010 different populations of Anio on the Big Island, and we have been trying to look if there is any potential or if there is any natural enemy already going after these thrips. But so far we haven't found anything that successfully decreases the population of these invasive pests. So we actually started working with the LNR, and we have been trying to treat some populations of this Nio papa in the cow area, because this is a very isolated population, and the thrips have been spreading really quickly there. Mm-hmm. And if this population is gone, so it will be really, really sad to have it disappear from that area. So we have been testing a couple of pesticides to see if we can at least save this population for now, and see which other management practices that are more sustainable can get in place.
Yes. I noticed from your research, and you've got some great research posted up on the internet, we were able to study up before the show, that one of the important things or targets being done by the Confederation of Organizations working together is quarantining and educating nurseries as well about the risks. So are we safe? It seems that Nio is probably an important horticultural trade plant. And are we safe here in the other Hawaiian Islands from the spread of Nio plants? Are Nio plants still coming from the Big Island from certified nurseries, or has it been cut off altogether?
Well, I don't have the latest information about that, but they shouldn't be trading any plants, especially Nio plants, from the Big Island to here, because Big Island is the source of the only source for now of Nio, so they shouldn't be trading any materials from the Big Island to here. It's so far, I think, it's still okay to trade Nio from here to there, but not from the Big Island anywhere else.
And is there a suspicion of how it actually arrived here in the Hawaiian Islands?
It probably came from California because that is the closest place where it had caused problems before. So, and some people in California, they actually see these strips as biocontrol agent because it goes after a mycorrhizal that some people consider it as a weed. Mm-hmm. So for them, hasn't been a problematic because there is no native NAO or native myoporin in California, but for us it's a completely different story.
Right. Well, let's move on to maybe a final insect that's affecting now both the native population or native plants as well as a lot of our agricultural or horticultural plants as well. That you've been looking at in depth, and that's the lobate lac scale?
Yes. We have been working on this project since last year. The lobate lac scale actually was detected here in Hawaii in 2012 in a botanical park like around the airport. So this invasive species actually has caused many detrimental effects in Florida and the Caribbean. So that's why we are at this moment trying to basically just survey the population on Oahu, because again, this species is only restricted to one island, and in this case it's Oahu. Mm. So it hasn't made it to any other island. So it's important to see which kind of information we can get from Oahu and see if we can get prepared in case if this pest gets into any other islands and we can quickly eradicate it.
Yes.
So for now, we are trying to update the list of host plants, especially native host plants, and we are surveying these invasive pests in different natural areas and hiking trails. And we are setting up permanent plots, and we are visiting some sites at 3-month intervals just to see what is the progress of the infestation in these areas and how quickly it's spreading in these areas. And we can maybe identify which kind of habitats are most preferred by these invasive species so that we know which habitats are in more risk, at more risks in other islands.
Well, it is a bit scary to read the list of host species that have been observed, at least in Florida, if not also in Hawaii, but it does include macadamia, mango, avocado, guava, many kinds of hibiscus, including our native hibiscus, as well as koa, gardenia, a'ali'i. And you mentioned the spread of them as well, and interesting to read that this is an all-female species that doesn't require fertilization of an egg to produce their young, that they reproduce with parthenogenesis.
That is actually one of the important points. Like, so this species can reproduce quickly, and especially here in Hawaii, given our climate, so it can really be a really bad pest. So we are therefore trying to really work on these surveys and try to update the list of species and see what is the actual infestation level, and see if we can do something, if the Hawaii Department of Agriculture or UH have to step in and look for a biocontrol agent that might be viable for us.
Well, I also was interested in the white peach scale that is hitting up the papaya trees. It's certainly something I've seen. I didn't have any proper identification specifically until I got to read your paper, Layla, but what is our best way to be able to identify exactly these scales that we're seeing? You know, I mean, our listeners are home gardeners for the most part and farmers, and they may see a scale and not know exactly what it is. What would be our best resource to help us identify which scale it is we're actually dealing with?
Well, scales sometimes are kind of tricky to identify because sometimes you need to mount them and you need to see them under the microscope. But, I mean, if you are a farmer and if you are curious to see what, like, if this is, which pest it is so that you can find the best treatment. So it's better to get in touch with your local station agent or ACOA office, and you can always take pictures, bring samples. I think samples are probably best because then people can really look at them.
Actually touch them and look at them in detail. Well, generally, how would we treat, say we were noticing a scale infestation either on papayas or one of the other trees that Paul mentioned with the other kind of scale, what would be a good way for us to start, you know, just so that we at least get the population under control, and while we're waiting for all this identification to happen, we're not just watching their population explode?
Well, I think the key thing about, like, managing a pest is catching it early. So I think, like, if you scout your plants regularly, you should be able to not to notice incipient infestation. And that is the time where it's key to manage your pest, because if you let it go and then you say, okay, I will check it maybe next week, and maybe next week it will be too late, and then you will have to spray your whole field, or you might already have, like, considerably infestation.
Sure. So are there any organic methods that you know of that aren't chemicals that can be used?
Yeah, we actually we were studying different methods that we can organically or sustainably go after different pests, like including white peach scale. So oils should work the best.
Oils.
Yeah.
And I noticed that the Omri listed product that you had a look at in your research actually is made from petroleum. I was surprised, and I also read that while it was the most effective and most cost effective, that it also caused there was more fruit that was then not marketable as a result of the application. And what is it about that? Is it an unsightly thing, or is it based on if you apply it too close to the harvest window that it's just not legal for sale, or what's the effect there?
I don't think oils are have that restriction, but you know, like when we did this study, what we noticed in the second round that we did it, like we started changing like the plants late. So I think what is key is when you start early, when we just start like doing periodic sprays. And you have to really kind of like cover the whole trunk and the leaves, the underside of the leaves for other pests, but specifically for white peach scale will be the trunks of the plant. So if you start doing it early, before you have considerably like a big infestation, that is when it works the best. So that's when we are seeing not only especially on the Big Island that we had the most production of fruit, even bigger fruit. So I think that is an option for farmers to look into, and probably the most cost effective if they want to try it.
Sure, prevention is always better than treatment.
Yes,
for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit and start talking about beneficial insects and potentially good pollinator plants for those. And I wonder what your experience is with those.
Well, I did my master's at Wageningen University, and I was looking at flowering plants that can boost beneficial, but also like there's the other side of the coin that sometimes when you work with where you try to pick some flowers that will attract your beneficial insects, your parasitoids, your pollinators, sometimes you can have the unwanted effect that you might actually attract some pests as well. So you have to be careful when you are trying to select a plant. Basically, there is kind of like a basic rule, like normally if you are trying to attract a specific like little parasitoids that will go after your aphids, that will go after your whiteflies or so on. So it might be better if you try to look for flowering plants with shallow corollas. So because these insects will try to eat this nectar that is a little bit thicker, whereas plants, flowering plants with deep corollas will attract more like bees that are good for you, but they may attract also some moths that have like this long proboscis and they like to eat more kind of liquidy nectar.
So the short corolla flowers would be something like a sunflower.
Yes, but more typically what you wanna use are these umbelliferas. For example, the coriander, fennel, dill, carrot, parsley, or plants of that sort.
Yes.
So in the carrot family. So these are flowers that are like like really tiny flowers that. If you hang around these plants, you will see tons of little insects coming after them. Yeah.
Yeah. When I looked up the parasitoid wasps, inevitably over and over again, the recommended plants for attracting them were parsley, dill, fennel, carrot, those family of plants. Generally speaking, across the board, it was very interesting.
Yes.
Although it looked to me like sun hemp also had some power to attract beneficial insects such as the hoverflies and...
Flowers that have a little bit in between, not like so deep corolla, that will be good for bees, for flies, that are beneficial flies. So also like other people use, for example, buckwheat or clovers, which are also good for attracting beneficials or bees.
Well, thanks again to the University of Hawaii and all the great work you guys do. We were able to access some information published by UH about beneficial insects and some of the recommendations given planting not only a diversity of flowering plants, but within that diversity, planting several or groups of that each given variety. So you don't just have one of something, but you actually have a whole banquet table full of that particular kind of flower to provide enough nectar. And it seems that the behaviors of bees is that they like to target in on something that they can go back and back to and have enough nectar of that particular variety available.
Mm-hmm.
As well, recommendations were selecting pest-resistant varieties of plants so that we're not using pesticides, which are often indiscriminate in terms of their what they kill. We're going to kill beneficials as well as the pests, and of course we want to be reducing our use of the pesticides in any way that we can. And also understanding the difference between bird-pollinated and insect-pollinated flowers seemed really important. Sometimes people will plant something like a bird of paradise and think that they're planting something for the bees, but it actually was evolved, designed to be pollinated by a bird, so not helping out the insects so much with plants in that category. So looking forward to hearing more of your research, and so grateful to hear that you are sticking around here in the Hawaiian Islands to share your passion for the natives, to be helping us out from an agricultural perspective. And if people want more information, Layla, can you direct them to some resources at UH, or would you like to share some of your contact information?
Yes. You can email me to Layla, it's Leyla, at hawaii.edu, or you can also call the lab phone, it's 808-956-2450.
Thanks so much, Layla. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. I'm ever more excited knowing that more and more of these pests seem to be showing up on our doorstep here on the island. And when we have such expertise as yours, like really on the front lines, it makes me feel like our plants are